Made in Latin America.
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 Made in Latin America. Latin America.
Welcome to Made in Latin America, a podcast brought to you by the Santo Domingo Center of Excellence for Latin American Research at the British Museum. Join Santo Domingo Center curators Laura Osorio Sanax and Magda Arauz Sieber on a road trip from the east to west coast of the United States and along the border with Mexico. In this season, you will listen to their various experiences visiting these places and conversing with leaders of fascinating cultural heritage projects that support and advocate for Hispanic, Latinx, and indigenous communities from a wide range of fields.
Hi, everyone. We are very excited to welcome you back to Made in Latin America podcast. And in this first episode, we are going to start a road trip in Houston, Texas, and we will visit three different projects along the way: Arte Público Press, Chicana por Mi Raza, and the International Center for the Arts of the Americas at the Museum of Fine Art, Houston. These three projects are exploring digital tools and using archives to make visible Hispanic and Latinx communities.
When we came to plan this trip, of course, the original focus was to look at majority Mexican, but also indigenous communities on the U.S. side of the USA-Mexico border. And while Magdalena and I were sort of talking, looking at the map, thinking about what, you know, where we might go, which projects we'd seen that looked interesting, how those correlated with the collection at the British Museum, we also started to think, actually, that we shouldn't be constrained by the border itself and that we should move organically between the United States and Mexico, and that we should effectively create a snake from Houston down to Mexico and so on until we got to the end.
Which, let me tell you, is not easy at all. Moving organically along the border is not something that it's possible.
not even if you're legal and you have European passports, which is our case. This was something that was completely and utterly functionally ridiculous. And so that idea of, at least in some symbolic, creative way, breaking the US-Mexico border for the project was impossible. And we spent much more time on the US side of the border than we did in Mexico. For various reasons, but mostly because we had such a hard time trying to get over the border in the first place.
Yay, what are we doing?
It's exciting. We're driving down the road in Houston. We're on our way to LA.
First day.
Looking at the sky, really, really big sky with beautiful clouds. Okay, so all we can say about Houston arriving was that we hired an enormous car that didn't think was going to fit between the lanes, but it did. And we tried, the first thing we did when we got out of the airport was we went straight to the Mexican barrio, ¿te acuerdas? And found not much because Houston is a load of main roads. And so we went to eat in a restaurant. And the idea was that, well, at this point, we were quite nervous. It's the beginning of the trip, and you don't know if you're going to get any good things, who you're going to meet, and whether they're going to think you're bonkers. And, of course, like anything, our idea of what the project was about or how important it was has solidified as the project went on and after. So at the time, we're still sort of unsure about the concept and so how to evangelize the people that we meet into thinking it's worthwhile talking to us.
But I think we were quite confident in the sense that the projects we identified in Houston were very interesting, and there were academics working on these different projects, and we thought we were speaking somehow the same language because we were coming from a museum, from the museum perspective, so we can have an interesting conversation about how we understand collections, archives, and how we want to use them in order to address present issues and discussions that are critical for Latin American communities. So we decided to visit three different projects, one of them called Arte Público Press in the University of Houston. And they are a publishing house which is dedicated to Hispanic Latino writers in the US, but they also have a program called Recovery Project, which is a massive effort of gathering all kinds of documents and books that have been written by Hispanics from the 16th century to the 1980s. Well, Gabriela, can you tell us the main goal of Arte Público Press?
Sure. So the main goal of Arte Público Press is to publish Latinos who write, U.S. Latinos who write from the United, from the geographic space of the United States. And these are, you know, people of Latino heritage who write, can write in English, Spanish, or Spanglish, creative works about anything related to Latinos.
And you have a project called Recovery, which is related to digital tools to recover U.S. Latino archives. Can you tell us more about it?
Sure. So the long title of our project is Recovering the U.S. Hispanic Literary Heritage Program. And that program began in the 1990s to recover the written legacy of Latinos from the colonial times up until the 1960s. Now we've extended it to 1980. That program was founded and is founded and directed by Dr. Nicolas Canelos and a group of scholars. And the goal was to recover the legacy, the written legacy of Latinos who had been contributing or who have been contributing to the United States as intellectuals, as community members, as cultural citizens within the United States. The recovery program took on the task of researching archives, small museums, cultural centers, community members, to locate, you know, any publication that was, you know, done by Latinos in Spanish or English. To date, we've documented that there were approximately 2,700 newspapers published in Spanish in the U.S. In-house here at the recovery program, we have approximately a record of 1,600 of them. We have physical copies of some of them. Of some of them, we have only like a few pages of the newspaper. We have at least, I don't know, like over 250,000 records that have been indexed from the newspapers that we've located, right, that document intellectuals, Latino, Latin American leaders who came to the United States and wrote in newspapers. We've been able through this project to demonstrate that Latin American leaders forged and worked under independence movements from the United States. So, Martí, Vasconcelos, many other leaders who were writing from the United States in publishing in the United States and then taking materials back to their countries. So stemming from that, we created the U.S. Latino Digital Humanities Center, which is a program or a center that is using all these archival materials to create digital projects that can showcase, some of these archives, make the archival materials accessible to communities. All of our projects are published in English and Spanish and in a free software that is easily usable and available to our communities so that people know that these materials exist, so that they can come to us to do more research, and so that we hopefully start to change the narrative that Latinos, that U.S. Latinos are not newcomers to the U.S., right, that we have been here for a long time, that Spanish was one of the first Western languages that was spoken in this territory. And that that we are, we are part of American history, American literature, the American, legacy.
And in that effort of like editing or rewriting the narratives of the U.S. Latinos, we were speaking about the keywords. Mm-hmm. So can you tell us more about how relevant keywords in searching are when we are talking about a database you're building now with digitized archives?
Absolutely. So one of the tasks that we have as scholars is working with the frameworks that are already established for us to make our materials accessible to the communities, right? To academic and community members. So we use the Library of Congress subject headings to create metadata about the assets that we're working from. And so tied to those, to that metadata, to the subject headings that we create, we also translate them into Spanish so that if that subject heading created by the Library of Congress is not representative of the communities or the materials that we're trying to present, we use the Spanish so that hopefully we're creating something that is better described and provides a more respectful, an authentic description of the project, of the object. And also we use subject headings as a way to provide additional materials and to hopefully anchor and properly describe those materials, right? So in a way, we use that as a sort of a Trojan horse. We use the system that is already in place, that has already been institutionalized, the protocols. These are the subject headings. And then we use the keywords to allow people to also use their own terms, right, to find hopefully those materials that they're looking for in our archives or in wherever our materials are. Whenever our materials are published, if they're published along with the metadata, they'll be able to find them easily because we'll have Library of Congress and the keywords.
Could you give us some examples of those concepts and terms that are quite violent and how you're trying to change that?
Sure. So the term, the clearest example that comes to my mind is the term illegal alien, right? That's a term that the Library of Congress uses for undocumented peoples. They have now changed it to undocumented alien. And so we circumvent that by, in Spanish, we use personas indocumentadas, ¿verdad? With the tags, we will, use a person's name, to humanize the individual. We will also use location for, to frame or contextualize that story so that we have like a place in Latin America, maybe in Latin America and then the United States. We use immigrant or immigration as another term. So we try to be very creative so that we do not, fall into the trap of continuing to like stereotype and work with these violent interpretations or descriptions of our community.
That was a very interesting meeting, right?
Fascinating. Really, really, really interesting women who are clearly doing an amazing project, I think. Yeah. So I suppose what I thought was really beautiful about it was when she was describing the name, the sort of changes in the way that the terminology that she uses for the Library of Congress. So she talks about undocumented alien and how she uses the names of people and the places that they come from, or words like undocumented immigrant to sort of subvert in a sense the categories that are fundamentally very violent on the part of the Library of Congress. And I think what's really beautiful about that is that just by using someone's name and saying where they're from and contextualizing it in that way, you're really, she used the word, right, humanizing, and it's the exact opposite of the word alien. Mm-hmm. And so here, it's not just the functional thing of what they're doing, which is they are fundamentally changing the ways that Latino people are described, undocumented immigrants are described in the United States through an institution as powerful as the Library of Congress. But they're also doing it in a really metaphorical, poetical way, right? They're showing the person behind the terminology.
Yeah, and that shows how relevant are those decisions when you're organizing information, data, when you're even like posting things. Everything you do to show if even if you want to do something good in terms of visibilizing these archives, the way you present them, that's extremely relevant. So the thing about the keywords and how they are using it is totally essential if you are wanting to give some social justice, right? Mm.
No, absolutely. And I mean, in that in itself, the whole sort of their social justice angle is brilliant, right? Because it is fundamentally a research project, right? It's a project about gathering archives and gathering more information. And that's something that frequently, I think, the project and the research perspectives can overtake the ultimate social justice mission, mm-hmm. right? And it just feels very much from the way that they're talking that that's not the case. I loved that conversation. And one of the things that I thought was interesting about one of coherence, let's say, between what they were trying to do and what we're trying to do, was that in a sense, it's quite abstract, right, for two curators to want to make a project in the United States, in part only because, in theory, the collection related to the United States is not under our purview as Latin American curators, as in to break that boundary of categorization. And we get around to talking to her, and she's talking about the violences inside the archive, and those violences are about designations and about how designations constrict and make invisible and cause all of this identitarian damage, right? So one example that she gave was alien, right? So, like, people being classified in the archives as aliens, i.e., you know, undocumented. And that's in the National Library of Congress. And so she was talking about how to work with that archive. So rather than dismiss the archive because you just decide that it's a racist structure that you don't want to be part of, it's how to work within structures like that to try to, I suppose, restitute some justice to the people who they represent, right?
And I think it's a very intense and heavy work to do, because it's little by little every time you upload something. But I do believe that this, from the perspective of the digital humanities, if you consider ethics when you're building these spaces and you're populating the internet, the way people and groups and communities are named is something so important to consider. So it's a very little step, but it has a major impact on how you present, how you disseminate the information. And what's also interesting is that this recovery project that is associated to this archive they're building has a lot of... It's an open data space. So a lot of people from the university, they're building digital spaces to provide better visualization of that database. So instead of just looking at spreadsheet and Excel sheets or a CSV or very complicated information, you can see a map. You can see connections within the Hispanic communities throughout the years. You can see a network of publications. You can explore different spaces. So if you go into their website, Arte Público Press, you can find different initiatives that are playing with those databases in order to disseminate it in a more digestible way.
But the other thing that I was going to say about them, which I quite liked, was precisely this conversation about... that I mentioned earlier, this conversation about who to platform, the question of who to platform, because I was wondering whether they did any work with people over the border, whether they did work with Mexicans who'd recently crossed the border, let's say, and so whose archive material might well still be in Mexico. And the answer was no, right? They don't work with anyone in any Latin American country because they rely on the structures that exist in those countries to support that material. And they support the material, which is principally the material of the diaspora, yeah?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I remember from that conversation, it was our first experience while being there of trying to understand the complexity of being Mexican Latino or US Latinx, all the difference and nuances between the different communities and how they're trying to identify as a different group from the Mexicans, which is part of the complexity of how you build your own identity in a country where you're part of the diasporic community.
The project had launched, if I remember rightly, in the Chicano movement.
Sí.
And mm-hmm. So what they were sort of saying was that they were having to navigate an identitarian situation where people... Effectively, some of them associated themselves with the Chicanos, and others wanted to distance themselves from that particular movement. Right? Yeah. There are certain projects that want to break the border, and in part, whether even if you're doing it, let's say symbolically, break the border down because of the violence that the border creates in its concept as well as in its reality. But then there are these incredibly radical, politicized social justice movements that put the border back in place, precisely because of what they do. Because of the violences that they do enact. So it's basically forcing us to acknowledge that the border means something. The border in this case means that the Latin Americans who live in Texas suffer discrimination in a way that doesn't apply to Mexico.
Yeah, yeah. And then Elvis, yeah. We're going to be effectively, like, munching on Americana for the next few months.
There are two reasons that I wanted to do the project, and the first one seems really obvious to anyone, I think, who studies culture or is interested in different cultures, which is that museums, even though they do lots of diverse programming and even though they're interesting and they often engage contemporary communities, they do still fundamentally work by classifying and categorizing different things and different people into set zones, specifically cultural areas and countries and language speakers and all kinds of things like that. So as a research center dedicated to Latin America, we very much wanted to show that Latin America is an amorphous concept that doesn't start at the border with Mexico and end with Chile. And while I think that diasporic communities and the fact of a globalized world is just deeply ingrained in people's heads, I still think it's worth subverting some of those labels, geographical cultural labels, in the museum space. So that's one reason. And then the other reason is a slightly more complicated one. The research center, the Santo Domingo Center, has, since its inception, it's been about platforming communities which are marginalized or minoritized in the places, you know, where they live, people where they live. And it's about showing that, for example, indigenous ceramics, which are sold for $5 on the marketplace, are just as important a contribution to the art world as, for example, things that are sold for hundreds of thousands of dollars in Sotheby's. It's about showing that knowledge systems are diverse and that, let's say, autodidacts, so people who didn't go to university, have just as important a knowledge systems when it comes to culture and the world as, for example, academics and researchers and the people that you typically see in museum spaces. What that's meant functionally for the center is that we have privileged those minoritized perspectives and made sure that when we, for example, make films or when we buy artists' work or when we invite researchers to come to the museum, it's been people from Latin America, that the money is always going towards people who don't necessarily have a voice and don't necessarily get a lot of work and therefore get a lot of money. Taking the Latin American perspective, generally, it's Afro-descendant communities or indigenous communities, let's say, that are minoritized, and then mainstream white, let's say, Latin Americans who are considered to be in a more privileged position. I know these are quite like blanket statements. Whereas taking, let's say, Mexicans in US territory, right, on the other side of the border, Mexicans who live in Mexico are considered to be privileged by the bare fact that they are acknowledged, not made invisible, they are legal, they have rights to vote, they have right to work, etc., in the country that they're from, and they are the majority population. And then when you get to the United States, they, whether they're indigenous or white, they are migrant workers, they're illegal, and they suffer from discrimination and racism. So it's about this constantly shifting lens, right, about whose voice gets platformed and in which context that is. But those are the two reasons that I thought.
So Chicana por mi raza is two things. It's a public website that highlights the work and women of the second wave and Chicano movements of the 60s and 70s. It is produced by myself and Maria Cotera. It is 13 years old as of this year.
Dr. Linda Garcia Merchant has this beautiful project called, more than beautiful, but very powerful and strong project called Chicana por mi raza, which is a digital memory collective.
We work with students at our institutions and institutions across the country to collect oral histories, digital archives, produce those digital archives, and introduce a number of students and the subjects we are interviewing to their roles and their contributions to second wave feminism in ways that they would not have read about or seen in textbooks or in classrooms. It really is a hidden history that we are uncovering and encouraging others to discover.
I was looking for digital projects involving Latinx or Hispanic communities in the U.S. and particularly in Houston. And I found Chicana por mi raza. And what I really liked at the very beginning was that this was an oral history project gathering testimonies from women and putting those out on a website and trying to build this archive based on their testimonies and publications throughout the decades of the long civil rights
era. How has this project, impacted new generations, or how are communities gathering around this digital archive and stories that you're pulling out?
So there's a couple of things going on here now. Students who were not aware of this are infinitely interested in it now. So there's a genuine curiosity. It is being used more and more in classroom spaces that were originally about specifically traditional women and gender studies, ethnic studies, Latino studies, cultural studies. Sometimes even in unexpected places like art classes and theater studies, museum studies, because we've had a couple of installations. And so students are not only discovering the work, but us as practitioners, as scholars, as scholar practitioners, who are very much about helping students see sometimes careers within the academy that they may not have known were available. More broadly understanding what it means to do digital humanities, because this is a digital humanities project. It's also a collection project and an oral history project, but it falls under the umbrella of digital humanities. A digital humanities project of color, which is something else that students don't necessarily or often see. That is pretty extensive. We have 14,000 assets in our collection and over 150 interviews from 13 years of collecting and regional projects. What's been most exciting is the regional and statewide work being done that introduces often students to their own state history about these women.
Yeah. So, yeah, we sent her an email. She was very open to have this conversation. We were also visiting already. We were visiting the Arte Público Press project, which is also part of the University of Houston. So it was quite easy to get in touch with her. And she was very interested in what we were doing as well. So we have a very long conversation about her project and ours. What's interesting here is that she's working with a group of Chicana women that were leaders in the fight for civil rights. And she's offering a model for grassroots digital history that it's encouraging further research into the understudies aspects of the American experience. That's her goal. And the overarching objective of Chicana por mi raza is providing this broad-based public access to oral history, material culture and correspondence and all kind of publications that are related to the long civil rights era.
And that's some really, really impressive work that we just heard about. And I don't know, I mean, probably we both sort of took away different things from what she was talking mm-hmm. about. For my part, what I thought was most interesting was the way that she describes her research project as a community of practice. So she involving, you know, community outreach, involving the research, involving, you know, sort of the digital operations, involving students and faculty, and them all intersecting in this space, which is a kind of contact zone, effectively. Mm-hmm. And she describes it as the archive es un encuentro, es un lugar de encuentro. It's a place, you know, of meeting people, of encounter. And I think that that's really beautiful because it's post-disciplinary, it's post-custodial, and it speaks to exactly how you know, research can be best done, which is within a community and through acts of sharing and intellectual generosity.
I found it really interesting that she's building this database with photographies, archives, newspapers, oral history, etc. And she's giving access to all the interviewees for them to edit the database so they can describe themselves, the objects they're donating for digitization or any other thing related to what they're talking about, and they have the authority to edit that and describe the things the way they want to do it. And it sounds really obvious, but that doesn't happen very often in the databases, right? Especially in museums or other kind of institutions. So I think it's really powerful and important to build a database where you have all the people involved in creating content and as a collaborative project.
Yeah, I mean, I think you're totally right. I mean, it's difficult, isn't it, for people to let go of their research project to that extent, of letting the people that produce the content effectively become the voice of the project. I think traditionally researchers themselves are the voice of the project. So I think that's really interesting. And as you say, it's particularly pertinent to museums in terms of representation, since museums are spaces in which the museum itself and the curators, who are the sort of liaison with communities, do the representing.
Say one of the things that I remember that she spoke about that I thought was so powerful, which was that she was talking about the interviews that she'd carried out with these women who were part of the movement in the 1970s, who were now mothers or grandmothers, and whose children and grandchildren didn't necessarily know that their parent, that their mother was this kind of like radical
leader.
Feminine.
Yeah,
yeah,
had
exactly.
No idea.
So these women were, you know, okay, yeah, I'll talk to you about it. You know, you can record me or whatever. And the daughter or something is sort of like in the kitchen listening and just completely and utterly taken aback by this other life that their mother has lived. And not only another life, right, but an incredibly powerful political role.
Yeah, and now I remember also that she was saying that while interviewing this woman, they started reconnecting with all these emotions and also strength. So they're on another stage in their lives, right? But the idea of talking about what they did and realizing that all what they did had a huge impact, social impact and generational impact, meant for them, they became so excited again about talking of all the things, the struggles they suffered and all the things they did and how they had to fight. So it was kind of a revival and refreshment of their spirits while they were talking. And I found that very, very moving, because it's not only about telling the story or gathering this digital oral archive, but also giving meaning back to life.
Somehow the strength of the project is beyond the documentary and the academic, and is very much about the personal interactions that she had with the families that she interviewed.
I don't know why that happens a lot within families, depending on the dynamics of a family, right? But many times we don't know which personality our grandparents had, or politically if they have changed, or if they were rebels, because now we see them as someone who's very settled into a certain way of living. So I think that's also an interesting topic to think about. How often we have these conversations with our grandparents or even parents on how they felt when they were young. If they struggle, the struggles we have nowadays, politically, emotionally, are similar to what they suffered at some point. Do we share that? Because usually this generational change always ends up in this, oh no, the new generation, they know nothing. It was much harder for us, et cetera, et cetera. But having these conversations or finding those stories on our website and being able to open those spaces and to discuss that, I think it's a very interesting culture as well.
Fieldwork I've ever done has been to some extent spontaneous, and so I have tried never to book too many hotels and too many transports, etc., in between, because you never know who you might meet who says, no, stay, come with me, let's do this. And so really all I ever need, to be honest, is a kind of bracketed flights from one way to another, and then a car that you pick up in an airport, and that you can, and then the rest of it, the details can be changed. The idea was that we had researched what we were going to do in Houston and some really fascinating projects in Houston, Austin, and Marfa. And we did strategically not plan anything else for the rest of the trip because we weren't sure how much time we would have, and so therefore how many places we'd be able to visit.
I guess somehow we first decided on which kind of projects we were looking for before starting the search. And for us, it was important to find community-based projects, everything related to Mexican, Hispanic, Latinx, or indigenous communities living in the U.S. mostly. So community-based projects, artistic projects that were happening, and research projects that were reflecting on these dynamics of the border, immigration, diaspora. So we started doing a Google search at the beginning to identify cities, areas, initiatives, universities, a very general search. And also we were looking for some connections with the collection as well. So we identify collections in the British Museum that were related to these areas that are closer to the US-Mexico border, and try to find projects, potential projects that we could build with people living there on one side or the other. So the Museum of Fine Arts in Houston is one of the largest museums in the United States, and they have a big collection on Latin American art. So we were interested to see if they have specific projects associated to that collection. That's how we found the International Center for the Arts of the Americas at the Museum of Fine Arts Houston.
You know, the ICAA is actually celebrating its 20th year this year, and the Documents Project has been, our digital archive has been online for over close to 15 years, I think, at this point. So it's shifted and grown and changed over the years, but I think one of the kind of core practices of Documents Project that sticks around for good reason is that, you know, we're a what you would call a post-custodial archive. That term wasn't really floating around when the Documents Project first started, but that's most certainly is the sort of impulse that we're coming from, which is to, you know, we work with teams of researchers or individual researchers, partner institutions across the hemispheres to locate the documents that come into the archive. And rather than the ICAA sort of say, we're looking, you know, we want documents on XYZ artists, which we may have opinions about that, we also let those researchers tell us who is important, which figures were maybe not on our radar yet or are missing from our archive, and that enables them to really have a role and a voice in contributing to this what is a globally accessible resource. More importantly, right, like we then enable those materials to actually stay where they live. When I teach students, I always, you know, kind of explain to them that think about if you were a student in Mexico City taking your first art history class and you decided that you wanted to work on a particular painting by Diego Rivera from his time in Europe, say, and you go, oh, Diego Rivera is from Mexico, and so I'm going to go to the Hermoteca and I'm going to look up Diego Rivera's papers, but then you find out that the papers that relate to that body of work are at MoMA in New York. and you don't have the resources to go to MoMA in New York. You know, access to information is a problem across the board, of course, and you know, we want materials to be preserved, but you know, I think as most often as materials can stay in their point of origin, that's the best way, and that's part of what's fantastic about a digital copy is that, you know, it serves two purposes. It's about preservation in one way, but I really think the vision of ICAA has always been less even about preservation and more about access. And I know it's something that, you know, I think any interview that you'll read with Marie Carvin about the ICAA, you'll see it, you know, really emphasize that this is an access project. And that is the core, you know, that we always keep in mind is, you know, we're making these materials accessible. But making documents accessible can happen on many levels. We also think it's not just enough to, you know, digitize something and put it online. That's great. But we go these other steps, make these other connections via the synopsis annotations that researchers write that accompany every document. That also is a really great tool for students who may or may not be familiar with Spanish or Portuguese or not familiar with English but are familiar with Spanish, that if they can't read the whole document themselves, they can at least get a sense of what the document is actually about. And would it be worth it for them to have it translated or, you know, go, if it's not their first, you know, first or second language, to go through the trouble of really reading through it themselves. It's another tool, it's another layer of accessibility that we're adding in there. But I think, you know, there are now a lot more players in the sort of sphere of digital humanities in Latin American and Latino art than there used to be. There's still pretty few and far between, but it's been exciting to see a lot of them grow. And we've been asked by, you know, a good number of these newer projects, some of them haven't even launched yet, you know, for advice on, you know, how they can utilize their digital platforms in ways that are meaningful beyond just making, you know, putting materials online or just beyond preserving them in a digital format, but actually, really making them meaningfully accessible. And, you know, we know that the ICAA, you know, it's been a project that's long running, and so it's been happening in phases. And another part that we're really interested in making more visible or known is the invisible labor that goes into archival work at large. Whether that's a physical archive or a digital archive, art historians, curators, you know, auction houses, gallerists, they utilize archives all the time, but very infrequently do they think about the work that goes into it and how something even like cataloging of documents has problems that relate to issues of, you know, colonization or possibly decolonization, right, depending on how we end up handling it. And that these fields of Latin American and Latinx art have suffered from a lack of attention around those standards and norms. And there have been projects like ours and many others that continue actively to contribute to things like the Getty's Art and Architecture Thesaurus, getting in the names of Latin American artists or other cultural figures that are not yet in those resources that are utilized globally, right? So, you know, what we don't want to do is keep replicating bad information, right? Incorrect information, because that's in the digital sphere that can be even more destructive, I would argue, than in an analog situation, just because of how fast that information can spread. So there's a lot of responsibility of the archive project itself, like on that granular level in the kind of nuts and bolts of how an archive works, that perform some of that work of, you know, decolonizing. I'm not a huge, like, I find the term gets thrown around a lot, and I think, you know, parsing out like the ways in which we're colonizing or decolonizing, I have a harder time sort of articulating in a short statement. But I think that a lot of that work is something that the ICAA has been doing from its inception, and that we will continue to do that good work with an eye towards those concerns and issues.
No, that's really fascinating. It's really interesting to hear you talk, and I think it's a democratizing project as well, isn't it? And it's beautiful, because I think that's what, I mean, I agree with you, decolonial, everybody uses it and meaning different things, right? But in the sense of making, let's say, breaking down some of the barriers around elite knowledge, that your archival project means that more people can do the research behind, you know, how they're engaging with art history and how they're engaging with objects, etc. So I think it's really interesting. And my question is perhaps a more political one, in the sense of going forward in the future. Which are the challenges that you perceive that your project might have to engage in the coming years, and perhaps challenges that are ongoing? And here I'm referring specifically to identities and the way that people subscribe to certain identities, i.e. Latin American or the Caribbean, Latino, Latina, Latinx, Chicana, Chicana, Chicanx.
I think it's certainly a challenge for any kind of institution or organization to stay on top of what are ever-changing and evolving terminologies, you know, that of course are highly loaded when it comes to, you know, terms that are utilized to describe specific identities. I think what is most important is not to shy away from those sticky areas and recognize that it is an evolution. You know, in the 60s, when Chicano started being utilized, that was contentious. It wasn't something that everyone adopted wholeheartedly. It still isn't a term that every you know, Mexican American adopts wholeheartedly, and nor should they have to. Language isn't fixed, right? We all know that, and I think it's about being a part of that conversation rather than, you know, trying to make definitive statements about, you know, what term is the preferred term that we're going to use all times. You know, it's hard, especially when you're a part of an institutional model. You know, you want to have consistency, you want to be messaging, you know, in the right way. But the reality is, you know, anyone that's working with these communities and these fields know that it transitions, it moves, it morphs, and that's an asset, in my opinion, rather than a detraction. You know, as the Documents Project is a curated, you know, I'm even hesitant to utilize that word, but it's an editorial project. It is curated. You know, our goal is not to collect every single letter ever written by any Latin American artist or Latinx artist in the world. That would be impossible and not very meaningful. Is that, you know, the work is slow. The work of research and archive building is incredibly slow. There's a lot of invisible labor that goes into it. And if anything, I wish people would understand that, like, we're very aware of the gaps and the holes that exist in our holdings. And, you know, it's super important to everyone that's on the project that we work to get those voices in there, to get that representation in here. That is why the project was established to begin with. The problem is, you know, to do this in any kind of meaningful way, it requires a lot of hard groundwork to be laid, first of all, and then second of all, like, the actual processing of the documents is incredibly labor intensive. So it's not a, you know, there's just been you have to strategically, you know, start somewhere, right? You've got to start at one place and then you're going to end up, you know, in another place eventually. And, you know, that's the work of the future, I think, is to continue to build upon our existing holdings, which are substantive and very, you know, represent a lot of the regions of Latin American. And we have strong holdings in Latinx art. But that is also one area, you know, at the earlier stages of the project, even finding the repositories in the U.S., finding Latinx-related materials, there wasn't as much available as there is now. So that landscape in and of itself has changed, and therefore that enables us to then ramp up in that regard and begin to address some of those gaps. That's just one example of where we're starting to push into the future. But, you know, I wish that I could say that there's a day that we will be representative of all peoples and all voices. That would be fantastic, and it's a goal. That certainly is a goal, but, you know, there needs to be a certain level of, like, patience and understanding while that hard work is actually performed.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. And also, I mean, since you are acknowledging that you've got all these gaps, I mean, as a curated project, you're acknowledging your positionality as a sort of body of research, and then it's up to another curated project in 150 years' time to play with those holes, right?
That's right.
What we do at the British Museum, right? Our collection is full of gaps.
Yeah.
And holes. And that's where those disarticulations in the collection, I think, is where there's some creativity that you use. So
absolutely,
it's always important to leave space, I think.
Absolutely. Well, we can't do it all. You know, one entity can't do it all on their own. So I welcome the colleagues out there that want to help do that other work of filling in some of those gaps in their own ways. Yeah.
Totally. So yeah, driving away from the Museum of Fine Arts in Houston, one of the most impactful, beautiful architectural spaces I think I've ever seen in the museum.
Yeah, what a spectacular building.
Yeah.
And lighting, beautiful museography as well, right?
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. But the point is that we went there to meet Arden Dekker and Alison Delima Green, right? So those were very interesting conversations. Like, sadly, we weren't able to record Alison Delima Green because she was really busy. But we did speak at length with Arden Dekker. It's fascinating to hear her perspectives, you know, on the documents project that she runs with Mari Carmen Ramirez, but also the way that what she brings to that digital project that comes from her formative education in Mexico City, right? And her work, which has been through sort of non-institutional interventions or radical interventions into institutions, and community artwork, effectively, because that's, as I understand it, what the Documents Project is all about, right? It's about facilitating the preservation of archives in Latin America and in the Latinx community that are important for local communities, and sort of training and giving resources to those institutions and organizations, right, so that they can do that.
Yeah, it was really interesting to hear Arden talking about that digitizing is first preserving, but most important is about access and democratizing and providing people with documents that contextualize this Latin America, Latinx art, right?
Yeah, look at that.
What's that giant head?
Charlie Chaplin, that's crazy.
Sculptures.
Yeah.
National heroes.
And is that a Spanish conquistador?
They look like, pero no, that's like El Quijote, right?
Oh, is it Don Quijote?
It looks like, pero it could be Hernán Cortés, right? Long beard, mustache.
So we're hanging on a minute.
Well, thank you for joining us today. On the next episode, we will drive from Houston to Austin to visit projects related to art in the most varied expressions. You run interventions, Latinx communities, and digital experimentation.
Thanks for joining us in this episode of Made in Latin America by the Santo Domingo Center of Excellence for Latin American Research at the British Museum. If you enjoyed it, don't forget to share, like, and rank the podcast on your favorite platform. To learn more about our projects, visit our website, sdcellarbritishmuseum.org, or follow us on Instagram at sdcellar.bm. This podcast is made possible by the generosity of Alejandro and Charlotte Santo Domingo and Mrs. Julio Mario Santo Domingo with Andres and Lauren Santo Domingo. Made in Latin America was engineered and edited by Pronk Productions. For more information, visit pronkproductions.com.